is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The search for suspects in the Bangkok bombing continues. Authorities in Thailand are continuing their search Wednesday for suspects in the Bangkok Hindu shrine explosion late Monday that killed at least 22 people, including several Asian tourists. More than 120 were wounded. A second blast occurred Tuesday in the Thai capital but caused no casualties. A Thai police official says security around tourist sites has been increased.
We have a place not just in Bangkok, all around the country, to take care of the tourist place, the crowded place, such as the skywalk and training station, the bus station, and the theater, every place.
There has been no claim of responsibility for Monday's bombing. The Erawan Shrine has been reopened to the public. South Sudan's government says it needs 2 weeks to consider a proposed peace deal with rebels that President Salva Kiir declined to sign Monday in Ethiopia. The United States Tuesday said it's deeply disappointed the Juba government didn't sign. John Kirby is a U.S. spokesman.
We certainly welcome the signing of this agreement by the opposition leader, and we continue to urge the government of South Sudan to also sign this agreement, which has been agreed by, supported by, not only the states of the Intergovernmental Agency for Development, but the United States, United Kingdom, Norway, China, the African Union, and the United Nations. So it's time to sign this agreement and to move forward for the South Sudanese people.
He also indicated the U.S. is consulting other governments about imposing U.N. sanctions on those undermining the peace process. South Sudanese Foreign Minister Barnaba Mariel Benjamin told VOA the document presented in Addis Ababa was no different than an earlier one. The government insisted that it be amended. This is VOA News. Another well-known Senate Democrat says he'll vote against the nuclear deal with Iran. New Jersey's Robert Menendez has joined New York's Chuck Schumer, insisting the deal leaves Iran with what he calls the core element of a robust nuclear infrastructure.
In essence, we thought the agreement would be rollback for rollback. You roll back your infrastructure, and we'll roll back our sanctions. And at the end of the day, what we appear to have is a rollback of sanctions and Iran only limiting its capability.
Two other Democratic senators, Jack Reed and Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, announced Tuesday they'll vote for the agreement when it is considered sometime before September 17. The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights reports the Islamic State group is resorting to reprisal killings and other measures to crush dissent in Sirte, Libya. Fighting erupted early this month after IS fighters shot dead a local imam known for his opposition to the militants. South Africa's Justice Minister Tuesday said he is seeking legal advice on whether a parole board has the right to decide whether to free Paralympian star Oscar Pistorius from jail after he was convicted of killing his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp last year. Pistorius has spent less than a year behind bars for culpable homicide. The 28-year-old blade runner is due to leave jail Friday. Logan Maestri is the South African Deputy Correctional Services Minister.
It is important to state that the offender was sentenced in terms of Section 276(1)(i) of the Criminal Procedure Act, which states that such an offender must be considered for placement under correctional supervision after serving at least 1/6 of his or her sentence, which in the case of this offender amounts to 10 months.
Prosecutors are seeking a more serious conviction of murder against Pistorius, which carries a minimum sentence of 15 years. The South African athlete insists the 2013 shooting was accidental, mistaking Steenkamp for an intruder. South African Anglican Archbishop and prominent anti-apartheid activist Desmond Tutu has been readmitted to a Cape Town hospital for treatment of an infection. His daughter, the Reverend Canon Mfo Tutu, spoke about her 83-year-old father.
His doctors assure us that he is strong but not young. The series of treatments that he has had have also had an impact on his body and his ability to come back from an illness.
The elder Tutu, a Nobel laureate, was released from hospital early this month after being treated for an illness related to prostate cancer. Gabon's President Ali Bongo has pledged to give his inheritance to the country's youth, saying they're the heirs of his father, Omar Bongo. The younger Bongo has led the oil-rich country since the 2009 election following the death of his father, who was president for over 41 years. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudanese hail President Salva Kiir for refusing to sign a peace deal.
As soon as we arrived today, there was a big crowd that welcomed the president and his delegation, including the peace negotiators, and they applauded the president for having taken a wise democratic decision.
Barnaba Merab Benjamin is South Sudan foreign minister. The head of the United Nations mission in the DRC says the mission must withdraw from the country. SADC leaders conclude their summit with a call to accelerate regional industrialization. And why is South Africa's opposition Democratic Alliance Party threatening a legal action?
In line with the findings of the public protector, we believe that the president has a responsibility to repay a reasonable proportion of those costs.
James Self is chairperson of the Opposition Democratic Alliance's federal executive. Selective C-section gains popularity in Kenya, and a program in Nigeria targets the country's malnutrition epidemic. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan's foreign minister says his government will today, Wednesday, begin consultations with civil society, political parties, and other stakeholders to determine how best to move the peace process forward. This after President Salva Kiir on Monday refused to sign a peace deal with rebel leader and former Vice President Riek Machar at the peace talks in Ethiopia. Mr. Kiir said he needs 15 days for consultations before signing a deal that is expected to end South Sudan's 20-month-old conflict. South Sudan Foreign Minister Barnaba Merab Benjamin tells reporter Peter Clotty that the proposed peace deal, which the president refused to sign, is unlikely to solve the conflict.
Our government has taken that decision because the document that they said was actually the final agreement on the peace process between the government and the other various opposition groups was the right document. And we felt, no, this, in fact, it was the same document that was presented last time. We shared with our citizens here in the country, various government institutions, civil society organizations, and political parties. And they had recommended that certain changes had to be made. We found that this document yesterday did not reflect what we thought should have been updated properly to include even the decisions which were taken by the Entebbe summit, which has recommended certain areas of that document infringe heavily and compromise the sovereignty of the Republic of South Sudan.
So, Dr. Benjamin, when will consultations begin?
It begins as we arrive today. As soon as we arrive today, there was a big crowd that welcomed the president and his delegation, including the peace negotiators, and they applauded the president for having taken a wise democratic decision. And, from tomorrow, the institutions will arrange a tabulated method of how we are going to consult with the communities of the Republic of South Sudan, including the people, the state. So there's a lot to be desired in this document.
Some people have called for targeted sanctions against your administration because of the refusal of the president to sign the deal that you said will compromise the country's sovereignty. What is your take on the call for targeted sanctions?
Well, I think sanctions really don't come in because our international partners, including international institutions like the Security Council, the African Union, and IGAD, is that they want to help South Sudan get peace and to reconcile with itself. I think they should not be burying this carrot stick of sanctions because that does not solve the problem, Peter. I think sanctions that we have seen, what sanctions have done across the world, they have not helped the citizens of any country for them to achieve the stability and the peace they always want. So I think what is important is to help the Republic of South Sudan be patient because this is a process. And I think our international friends should really be understanding us. We are glad that the international friends did not also sign because they say there is no agreement by one person, the United Kingdom. They said they have not read this document and they need to go through it first. So there are a lot of inefficiencies that has come out of this document.
Barnaba Merab Benjamin is South Sudan's foreign minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Juba. South Africa's opposition Democratic Alliance Party is threatening legal action against President Jacob Zuma, the Speaker of Parliament, and the Ministry of Police to force them to accept the report of the Public Protector, the country's anti-corruption body, concerning renovations made to President Zuma's private home. The agency ruled last year that the president benefited unduly from using state money to improve his rural home, costing taxpayers about $23 million. But the ruling African National Congress majority in parliament on Tuesday decided to exonerate President Zuma of his responsibility to pay back the cost of the non-security aspect of the renovation. James Self, chairperson of the Opposition Democratic Alliance's federal executive, says the parliamentary committee that went to see the upgrade believed the $23 million spent on the president's private residence was irregular.
Our contention is that we have an institution in South Africa called the Public Protector that is similar to an ombudsperson, and the Public Protector made some findings around the liability of President Zuma to repay public money that had been spent on his private residence for so-called security upgrades. We, who served on the committee of parliament that went to go and see those upgrades, believed that that expenditure was irregular and that it substantially enhanced the value of his private residence. And in line with the findings of the Public Protector, we believe that the president has a responsibility to repay a reasonable proportion of those costs.
What is it that the opposition is going to do? What are the options left for the opposition?
We hoped that the majority party would accept our minority report, but in the event that they did not do so, we will tomorrow be serving legal papers on the president, on the Speaker of the National Assembly, on the Minister of Police to force them to accept the remedial action that was ordered by the Public Protector, which was that the president had to pay back a reasonable proportion of the costs of the non-security aspect of the upgrades to his private home.
To the credit of President Zuma and the ruling National Congress Party, they have said that the fire pool was there to be used to serve as a water source for firefighting.
Yeah, well, the fire pool is what you and I would both describe as a swimming pool. It has a deep end and it has a shallow end. It is tiled. It has a childproof net across it. It is a swimming pool. There's nothing else to describe it as. And in any event, there are no pumps anywhere available in the vicinity of the president's household that could be used to employ the water that is in this tank to fight a fire. And the fire chief of that municipality told me personally that by the time they got there, if there was a fire, it would have destroyed all the buildings in any event. So we regard this thing as a complete chimera. It is a swimming pool. It was intended to be a swimming pool. It has no force and effect in terms of fighting fires at the president's private residence.
James Self is chairperson of the Opposition Democratic Alliance's federal executive. He was speaking with me from Cape Town, South Africa. Today's Wednesday, August 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 and a half minutes past the hour. Leaders of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, concluded their summit Tuesday in Botswana's capital, Gaborone, with a call for the region to accelerate industrialization. Host President Ian Khama assumed the chairmanship from Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe. In this exclusive interview with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe's service, SADC Executive Secretary Stergomena Lawrence Tax says the region's industrialization is being hampered by lack of funding.
The heads of state, they looked at both the political front but also the economic front. From the economic front, they received a report on where we are in terms of our industrialization strategy. They appreciated the work which has taken place. But what we are doing currently is to prepare the action plan for the strategy. So that is a priority. But also they recognize that for us to be able to implement the strategy, apart from the commitment by the member state, we need resources, and we cannot depend on resources from contribution by member states. So the importance of private sector being part of this endeavor was very much emphasized because they are key implementers and key partners, but also getting alternative sources of funds, not just like waiting for member states' contribution or international cooperating partners was emphasized. That being the case, we, as the Secretariat and the Council of Ministers, have been directed to finalize. Already we have started working on alternative sources of funds, directed to finalize that work as quickly as possible to report to the next summit, which is in August. But that also goes hand in hand with in the major decision in that regard, also for them to be able to ensure that we are really focused on industrialization. From now on, they'll be receiving reports on progress on key milestones in each and every ordinary summit.
Lastly, Doctor, there are some who are saying the economic situation in Zimbabwe is deteriorating and might be a cause for concern. Is this a country that you are also looking at in future?
Obviously, Zimbabwe is our member state, and whoever is saying the economic situation is deteriorating, I don't know what are the factors which we are looking into. If you look at the microeconomic indicators, that is not the indication. And if you go there, you'll be there on the ground. You'll see a lot of economic development which is taking place, infrastructure is booming up. Even the, you know, sometimes we are deceived by the numbers. And the numbers also depend on the analysis, who does the analysis. But you go there, you can see really that economic, the economy is booming up. But that was not a matter of which was discussed in the summit, but economic development, it is picking up compared to where they were during the sanction period.
That was SADC Executive Secretary Sir Gumina Lawrence Tax speaking from Gaborone, Botswana, with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe Service. The head of the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Martin Kobler, has told reporters that the mission, known as MONUSCO, must withdraw from the DRC. Kobler said the recent decision by the Ethiopian Airlines to restart flights to Goma in the eastern Congo is a welcome step toward MONUSCO's withdrawal. Nick Long has more for VOA from Goma.
Kobler spoke at Goma Airport after landing there aboard an Ethiopian Airlines jet. Ethiopian is the only international carrier flying direct to Congo from outside the DRC. It started the flights last month, just 6 weeks after a night attack on the airport by gunmen who were repelled by security forces.
Je suis très fier aujourd'hui. Merci bien pour le gouvernement de la RDC, pour le bailleur de fonds.
Kobler tells reporters he feels very proud at this moment and he wants to thank the DRC government and its donors. It is very important to develop the economy here, he says, and this economic link with the outside world is what the people of Eastern Congo need. Goma and the surrounding province have come a long way in the past 2 years since Kobler took over as head of MONUSCO. In mid-2013, the M23 rebel group controlled the hills north of the city and mortar rounds were falling in the streets. Under Kobler's leadership, MONUSCO played a key role in helping the Congolese army defeat M23 and improve security across the east of the country. As other crises beckon, the UN Security Council is now anxious for MONUSCO to wind down. We're now discussing MONUSCO's withdrawal with the government, says Kobler, and that also means reducing our fleet of planes. Why use MONUSCO flights if there's an alternative? We must now withdraw from the country, and having these direct flights here is a step towards that, he says. A spokesman for civil society groups in Goma, Gento Mandu, told VOA the Congolese army was lucky to have MONUSCO's support. He said the groups are concerned that recently MONUSCO and the army have not been collaborating fully against all the armed groups, some of which are still resisting state authority. There's a disagreement between MONUSCO and the army, says Mandu, and we think that's why Kobler, whom we respect very much, is talking of withdrawing his troops. There has been tough fighting in the past few weeks between the army and several armed groups. Mando said even the foreign armed groups like the FDLR and ADF NALU contain many Congolese fighters, and civil society could help persuade them to lay down their arms. He says he favours dialogue because that way all sides can be heard and their claims put on the table to see how peace can be restored to Congo. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
A number of Kenyan women are turning what used to be an emergency birth procedure into a must-have in some hospitals. The increase in elective C-sections mirrors a trend in the West and is happening despite warnings from medical experts who said it should remain a last resort. Rael Ombuo has more from Nairobi.
In Kenya, C-section delivery is becoming more common within the urban population, especially among the well-to-do. The women who opt for elective C-section says that natural birth comes with complications like long hours in labor, physical pain of pushing, and permanent changes in their bodies. Jen Mukami is a communications officer with a non-governmental organization in Nairobi. She says that based on her personal research and word of mouth from friends, she opted for an elective C-section.
This being my first baby, I was really afraid of giving birth naturally because of the pain during labor. So I opted to just have a C-section done. And then my peers also were telling me how painful it is, and some even fainted and all that. So I was really scared. And then there's another issue. Okay, when you give birth naturally, you know, like you can't be intimate for a number of months, maybe with your husband. And I didn't want to have it that way. So C-section was the best option for me.
Dr. Peter Murimi is a gynecologist at Nyeri Aga Khan Hospital. He says this trend is growing at an alarming rate among young women and is steered by bad advice and misconceptions.
There's a new trend emerging, especially among young women, whereby most of them, by the time they reach they're almost term, that is, they're completing their 9 months, most of them are opting to have cesarean section delivery rather than go the natural process because they're fearing the pain. Some are saying that if you have a natural birth, you may have damage in the birth canal and everything, and that may bring out issues later. But you see, those are things which are based on a fallacy, and they're actually baseless.
But Mukami argues Kenya's health institutions are well equipped to handle surgeries, and that with proper planning, any woman can pull off a safe delivery via C-section.
In Kenya, currently, we have very good hospitals and very professional doctors. For example, Nairobi Hospital, it's one of the best. And as long as you have planned well for your baby, by that I mean you have good money and you've chosen a nice hospital where they have good doctors, you don't have to worry about anything. You'll just feel safe.
Not all Kenyan women have sufficient money, of course. And according to Dr. Murimi, about half of women who undergo elective C-sections suffer adhesions. He advises that a natural birth is safer than a C-section.
I always tell any woman who's capable of giving birth naturally to use that method. And if it's going to be a cesarean section, let that be due to an indication. Do not just do that out of a preference. Let it be because your body cannot handle it. That is just the final word. A cesarean section should be an intervention. It should not be the first option.
According to the World Health Organization, C-section delivery rates are low in sub-Saharan Africa, being used in less than 2% of births. Rael Ombuor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigeria has one of the highest numbers of malnourished children in the world, but data released this week shows that a program run by the Nigerian government and the UN Children's Fund is saving children's lives by getting them to eat more nutritious food. Chris Time has more from VOA's Regional Bureau in Dakar.
In Nigeria, approximately 1.7 million children under the age of 5 are severely acutely malnourished. About 361,000 die from causes linked to malnutrition every year. The country's north bears the brunt of the epidemic, says Aryan Dawat, UNICEF's chief of nutrition in Nigeria. He says the crisis is perpetuated by a combination of poverty, lack of education, early marriage, and, in parts of the northeast, the insurgency by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram.
Now, in the northern part of the country, also, for instance, education level and literacy levels are lower. And we also know that poverty in the northern part of the country is generally higher than we see in the south.
In 2009, the Nigerian government and UNICEF rolled out a pilot program that eventually expanded to 11 states in the north. The program, called Community-Based Management of Acute Malnutrition, works by bringing in children and their parents or caregivers for weekly appointments at clinics, where they're taught about topics like nutrition and breastfeeding. The children are weighed and checked for illnesses. The families leave with supplies of high-nutrition food for the children. The program appears to be getting results. Dawat says the data released this week shows the program has cured up to 830,000 children of malnutrition. and saved thousands of lives.
More than 200,000 children are alive today. They wouldn't have been alive if the program wouldn't have been there.
Much remains to be done in Nigeria and elsewhere. UNICEF says the 1.7 million malnourished children under 5 in Nigeria account for just a tenth of the total worldwide. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
Minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with basketball. Nigeria play the Central African Republic as hosts Tunisia engage Uganda in Group A action at the start of the Africa Men's Basketball Championships in Tunis today, Wednesday. In Group C action, Egypt play Gabon, then Mali encounter Cameroon. There are 16 teams in the contest, and the winner of the 12-day tournament automatically qualifies for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Turning to athletics, any athlete who sets a world record at the IAAF World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China, stands to earn $100,000 bonus besides their normal prize money, the World Athletics governing body IAAF revealed in Beijing on Tuesday. The World Athletics Championships, which is the third biggest and most prestigious global sports event after the Summer Olympics and FIFA World Cup, starts on Saturday and runs until the 30th of August. Japanese Communications Corporation, TDK, is sponsoring the men's world record bonus prize, while Japan's Toyota Motor Corporation is sponsoring the women's world record bonus prize. The IAAF stressed that prize money and bonuses will only be disbursed after the athletes' performance are ratified, which also includes clearing the relevant anti-doping procedures. Staying in Beijing, the Confederation of African Athletics President Ahmed Kalkaba Malbum and Kenyan Isaiah Kiplagat are among seven candidates vying for the four seats for the International Association of Athletics Federation, IAAF Vice President, when the World Athletics Governing Body holds their elections today, Wednesday. With Senegal's Lamine Diack stepping down as IAAF President, Britain's Sebastian Coe and Ukraine's Sergei Bubka are vying to replace him. As IAAF Senior Vice President, Lamine Diack was first elevated to acting IAAF President when the then IAAF President Primo Nebbiolo of Italy passed away in 1999. Diack was subsequently elected IAAF president in 2001. There are 49 candidates vying to be elected to the 15 seats available for individual IAAF executive committee members, six of which are reserved for women. Over 200 national athletics federations will cast their vote to elect the new team to steer the IAAF ship for the next 4 years. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, August 19th.
Good morning, Daybreak Africa and listeners across the world. Permit me use your media once again to call on Nigeria political class to remember that for good governance to be achieved in Nigeria, we must avoid political parties from interfering into public governance. Albert Alago, from Obudu Kato Ranch, Bechiva Ward, in Obanikuluka Government area of Cross River State, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment. And that's it for this Wednesday, August 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer David Vandy, reporters Peter Claudie and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Please join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 1700 hours UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests to share their ideas and enlighten us all on the topic at hand. So please, plan to be with us every Thursday at 1700 hours UTC on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.
The lyrics.
lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.